Welcome back to the Fifth Estate podcast from the Wheeler Center. David Nywert is a journalist who specializes in researching American right-wing extremism. In this conversation, recorded live at the 2018 Melbourne Writers Festival, he talks about his work with our host, Sally Warhaft.
Nywert is an investigative journalist. He's based in Seattle, and he's the Pacific Northwest correspondent for the Southern Poverty Law Center. His most recent book is Alt-America, The Rise of the Radicalized Right in the Age of Trump. And just to let you know, he will be signing copies of it in the atrium after this event today. David arrived on Friday. It's his first visit to Australia. And of course, like we do as often as we can for visiting international guests, we provided a prime ministerial switch. So please give David a warm Melbourne welcome.
And not to mention a demonstration out here in the plaza yesterday.
That's right. Yeah.
Where I felt like right at home.
Yeah, we like to put it on, David. That's we'll find out in the course of this conversation just how good at that we are. But we'll see. I'm going to start off with a short quote from David's book, just to set the tone. Ladies and gentlemen, in American public life, there is an alternative dimension, a mental space beyond fact or logic, where the rules of evidence are replaced by paranoia. Welcome to alternative America, alt America for short.
That was meant to be read in a Rod Serling voice.
By yeah, the way. Yeah. Sorry about that. You write in the rise of alt America, and it's the first thing I guess we need to understand about it, that Donald Trump represents the culmination of a trend that really began in the 1980s, that it goes back to Bill Clinton, it went into a hiatus under Bush and came roaring back to life under Obama. So can you just talk us through the timeline and what's really important about that period of time?
Sure. Well, the core concept of alt-America is that this understanding that the radical right really lives in a kind of epistemological bubble, an alternative universe, as it were, which I call alt-America, that is constructed of conspiracy theories, alternative theories of what the Constitution means, and alternative facts, as it were, which is, I think, the phrase that the Trump administration prefers. And but I really started seeing this in the 1990s when I was writing about covering the militia movement in the United States, and I actually wrote about it in my first book on the militia movement that I published in 99. And this alternative universe has been promoted and promulgated by people like Alex Jones and various other conspiracy theorists, as well as people like Rush Limbaugh, where they basically try to create a narrative that's more congenial to them, but is also ultimately leads to profound distrust of the mainstream media and the usual authorities that provide us with facts and understanding of what the news is. So in the 90s, it was very much a very limited bubble, but it kept growing, particularly after 9/11, with the growth of the whole truther, 9/11 truth conspiracy theories. And it remained sublimated during those Bush years, but it actually did grow quite a bit. It was sublimated mainly because it didn't obviously have the support of the mainstream conservatives, since the object of the 9/11 truth theories was George W. Bush. Right, so there was this big gap between the mainstream conservative movement and people on the radical right who see the world in very conspiracist terms. And but what we did see going on during those Bush years was also really a very deep rise in authoritarianism, authoritarian personalities, and pushing. Especially it was, you know, during the Iraq War, anybody who was questioned Bush was accused of, you know, being soft on terrorism and hating America and that sort of thing. So that was very much part of what was going on, even within mainstream conservatism. And the gap between that conspiracist element and mainstream conservatism went away as soon as Barack Obama won election. It started vanishing actually as soon as he announced his candidacy. But once he won, then the two very much became the same. And this was manifested in the Tea Party movement, which was this really powerful reaction to Obama's election. And of course, the Tea Party was sold to the public, particularly through right-wing media and honestly, mainstream media like CNN, as being this, being supposedly about, you know, holding back taxes and stopping the deficit and you know, stopping this crazy overspending as we tried to recover from the 2008 recession.
So it was the Tea Party that provided that bridge that gave legitimacy to the far out right.
Yeah, and within, I would say, 6-8 months of the Tea Party forming, even before that, really very early on in the Tea Party, we were seeing all these signs that these old ideas and talking points and agenda that we'd seen originate back in the 1990s with the militia movement were being transmitted right into the middle of mainstream conservatism, very much part of the movement, the Tea Party movement itself. I don't know if any of you are familiar with the Gadsden flag. This is the yellow flag with the rattlesnake on it that says, "Don't tread on me." This was the symbol of the Tea Party movement. But I was very familiar with that symbol because it had been actually revived by the militia movement in the 1990s. And whenever I would see that flag up until 2008, I would go, "There's a militiaman," because it was a very easy way to identify somebody who was part of the radical right, was somebody who was carrying that flag. Well, it became the symbol of the Tea Party movement and was at all these Tea Party rallies and is still to this day in the popular mind very much more associated with the Tea Party than it is with the militia movement.
I think most Australians, you know, are staggered when you're confronted with the number and range of different groups in America, of all different sort of priorities, I suppose, certainly compared to here. The Southern Poverty Law Centre has tracked their activities and the violence connected to some of these groups over many years. And you saw real spikes in what you call domestic terrorism during the Obama years. But you write that no one noticed.
Yeah, it was hardly even paid any attention to. Typically what would happen when we'd have a right-wing domestic terrorism incident is that it would be depicted as an isolated incident and that the ideological component of the action was typically very sublimated in the coverage. And so it was, hardly noticed by anybody who was sitting on the outside. Of course, those of us who were close to it could see right away that we were seeing this significant increase in domestic terrorism. It just kept happening and happening and kept getting reported as an isolated incident involving somebody who was mentally ill or whatever. You know, they would find various ways. You know, of course, if they'd had a turban on their head or had an Arabic name, it would have been immediately decried as Muslim terrorism. Mm.
Well, what's the beating heart that's in every one of these groups? What do they all share?
Antagonism to liberalism, frankly. I think it's really anti-liberalism in many ways. Deep antagonism to multiculturalism, antagonism to the changes that happen to society because of multiculturalism, and but it takes many shapes, including when you look at the alt-right. This is the more radical end of it. They want to create a white nationalist ethnostate, a white ethnostate, free of people of color, and you don't see that necessarily in the more the less obvious folks, but I know you had Lauren Southern here just and Stephen Molyneux just a few weeks ago. And, and Southern's got this film out about the South African farmers. It's just a classic white nationalist theme and story idea that they're promoting. And this is one of the things that I know she was promoting here. So you certainly got a taste of it.
What your book describes is a sort of unholy convergence of several factors that sort of seemed to happen at the same time. There was the rise of the internet, and mm-hmm. we'll get back to each one of these, but that was the first. And a convergence with mainstream media and alternative media, and then the rise of Donald Trump. That these three things sort of seem to happen within a few years of each other. Tell us, well, first of all, let's look at the internet about what happened, because you describe all these groups that were increasing their membership and then it stopped. And what you realised was they were going online instead.
Yes.
So tell us about why that mattered so much.
Well, it certainly was a change for those of us who've done work with the Southern Poverty Law Center for a long time, because SPLC is very well known for tracking hate groups in America, and we publish a map that you can go online and see that details all of these hate groups, where they're based, and what their ideologies are. But around 2014, we started realizing that actually hate group numbers and membership were starting to decline, and it didn't have to do with there wasn't anybody drifting away from the ideology. Rather, what we were seeing was people becoming fully radicalized online without ever having to join one of these groups. And the consummation of this, or I would say apotheosis of it, was Dylann Roof. The young man who walked into a black church the day after Donald Trump announced his candidacy and killed 9 people in a church, black church in Charleston. He didn't belong to any of these radical groups that we know of, but he was going online at places like the Daily Stormer and the Council of Conservative Citizens, and was sort of inculcated in his mind these beliefs that, black people were steadily killing white people in America and that he needed to do something about it.
And one of the really notable differences online and in this contemporary, alt-right is they're using different tactics online. You alluded to one before with the snake symbol, but mm-hmm. they're using humour. They're using cartoon characters, popular culture, mm-hmm. Incredibly effectively, it seems, to lure people in. So, who are they luring? What's the is there a demographic? Mm-hmm. We underestimate, of course, in the intelligence of people that are drawn to these groups.
Yes.
So frame it for us, who these people are and these new tactics that they're using?
Well, the alt-right in particular is... the Patriot Militia movement is associated with all this, and they're a distinct sort of movement from the alt-right. But the alt-right in particular, being primarily an online phenomenon, it's this sort of a bizarre mix of very old ideology. And fundamentally, their ideology is the same sort of eugenicist, white supremacist thinking that we saw in the 1920s in the United States and elsewhere around the world, and has always remained on the fringes of our political discourse. But the way it's always expressed itself over the years in organizations like the Ku Klux Klan and Aryan Nations was always very backward looking, because they were always wanting to, you know, revive this golden era of America and so on and so forth. And so typically the kind of people we would see attracted to these movements were middle-aged to elderly. And that was certainly true of the Patriot Militia movement. A lot of those folks that were, you know, middle-aged and older. The demographic of the alt-right is, you know, they clearly are aimed at recruiting young white males between the ages of 16 and 30. Mm. That's their demographic. And they're doing it through, yes, the very adept and, I would say, clever manipulation of social media. As you mentioned, they use a lot of humor, and it's, mind you, it's very transgressive humor. It's the kind of humor that's actually aimed at young men between the ages of 15 and 30, and that is very transgressive. Mm. It's like the more racist and nasty and the better it is, because, you know, we're gonna be out there on the edge sort of thing, the way a teenager enjoys sort of blowing up the world. Mm-hmm. And that's what they're about. So it's a very, very insidious, sorry about that, very insidious sort of thing, in that it's directed at our young people. And it's very clearly what I've been seeing out on the streets, because I have to go cover these events that have been turning into riots, very violent scenes in the United States. These are all young guys.
And there's a lot of them.
Yeah, there's a fair number of them.
What sort of numbers are we talking about?
Well, I would say, you know, when we look at the internet, it's very hard to get a feel for it, because it is almost all online. So we can't really get membership numbers in the way we used to be able with hate groups. But when we look at internet traffic numbers, thumb rule that we use is basically that we're seeing hundreds of thousands of people visiting these sites and participating. And potentially millions of them. We know that, and somebody did a survey recently where they estimated that, you know, something like 24 million Americans share the views of the alt-right. That doesn't mean that these are people are all participating in the alt-right, but it does mean that there's a huge audience out there for them. Mm-hmm.
So. The attraction to conspiracy theories and so on has always featured, hasn't it, in US polling. Mind you, we probably don't do as much of it here. If we did, it could well be the same. But what is distinctively American about alt-America?
Well, most of it's the actual subject of it, such as, you know, views of the Constitution, the American Constitution, or views of American politics. But it's also views of the very polyglot culture, multiculturalism that's actually been more successful, I think, in the United States than just about anywhere else. When I've been to Europe, I think a lot of the problems that they're having there are the fact that they don't handle immigration and multiculturalism very well because they're still caught up in sort of an old European mindset where, you know, you can only be French if you are born in France, right? And it's so we don't have that problem in the States, except that there is still a mindset that's been around for a very long time that being American means being white, right? And this goes back, this dates back to long, long ago, back to at least the early 1900s.
So. It's your first time to Australia, but you've watched from a distance our politics since 1996. And give us your sense of things here and what's different here.
You're still sane.
we don't have guns.
There is that. Actually, it's true. I mean, one of the things that comes up in conversations in the States a lot is, especially after Parkland and events like that, is that people in the States go, why can't we be like Australia? You know, when you had the horrible mass shooting in
96,
yeah. You actually did something about it. And the difference is you don't have an NRA here. That's a very powerful lobbying arm. The National Rifle Association is very powerful in Washington, and they've been very successful at preventing any of this, any change in gun laws. So there is that, you know, and obviously the NRA has over the particularly during the Obama years, has become itself increasingly radicalized as well.
But when you talk about, and in the book you go into real detail about this, about, you know, that things start in sort of, you know, mainstream press and so on, and then they've sort of toxified into other elements. Now, an example, you know, from Australia in January this year, and it always seems to happen in January when, you know, the country's on holidays, but particularly this year because there was a state election and so, oh gosh, we have to get in on the crime and punishment, law and order state election coming up. So, of course, the Herald Sun comes out with an idea that there are Sudanese gangs running riot in this city. And then the Home Minister, the now spectacularly failed Prime Ministerial candidate, Peter Dutton, suggests that Melburnians are too afraid to go to restaurants because of these Sudanese gangs.
Do you have no-go zones?
No, we do not have no-go zones. And, I mean, it really, it was very inflammatory, and it was not backed up by any fair weighted contextual sort of evidence. But of course it took off and up until the point where just a couple of weeks ago our then Prime Minister, if you can possibly keep up with this, Malcolm Turnbull, pretending that he was friends with his then Home Minister Peter Dutton, came out and basically gave it some substance. You know, I think people just in a couple of weeks forgot about this, that a Prime Minister who on Friday got up and talked about how proud he was of the multi-culti credentials of this wonderful country just 2 weeks ago stood next to that man because it politically benefited him in that moment, suggesting that he had a point. Now, when you have stories, how dangerous are these moments?
Very. In fact, I would say immigration has been the number one issue for being a transmitter or sort of transmission belt for this radicalism in the United States. We certainly started seeing the radical right organize around immigration issues beginning in the late 90s. And it really intensified Actually, through the Bush years, we saw organizations like the Minutemen, who were these vigilante border watchers who would go down on the border in Arizona and Texas. And I did write a book about them as well. And they wound up being a murderous gang of criminals, essentially, by the time their whole career was over. But those attitudes very much came up through immigration, and immigration is still the primary bugbear of these of the radical right. You hear them, complaining incessantly about the fact. I mean, this is the focus of the people who want to create a white ethnostate, that they want to deport all these non-whites that have come to the country and make it all white people.
Mm. You'd be aware of that. It's an ongoing issue mm-hmm. here, and I think the next mm-hmm. election it's going to be a hugely prominent issue, immigration.
Yeah. Well, as I mentioned to you when we were chatting before, I did work for a year at I worked for 4 years at MSNBC, but my first year there, I was in charge of the Australia News section because the folks in the Sydney Bureau weren't able to put things up on the web yet because the technology was all very new. So I was doing it for them back in Seattle on the Microsoft
campus.
Let
me interrupt you. Is his mic dropped out a bit again?
Is that it? Yeah, that's okay,
better.
Good.
Yeah.
On the Microsoft campus. And so... I was running a lot of stories about Pauline Hanson, my very strong recollection was that there was a tremendous amount of anti-Asian sentiment going around Australia then. And so, immigration has been an issue here for a very long time. It is definitely one of the sort of roots or the main avenues for this push for the radical right. Mm-hmm. And my own sense of what's going on in Australia is that you're like 3 or 4 years behind us.
Is that old?
Yeah. Well, no, I would say that the conditions are similar to what I would have seen in 2012 or so, or 14. So, yeah, this rally that was out here yesterday in Federation Square, I did go cover it, as it were, and talk to a number of the people who were there participating. And there's sort of like a very light version of these profoundly misogynist men's rights movement that we have in the United States. The guys that I would talk to here in the square were, not as openly misogynist and weren't as even overtly anti-feminist as what we have with the same faction in the U.S., but they're getting there. Mm. So.
What we don't have is Donald Trump, and who seems a uniquely American figure. Tell us about.
Well, you've got Bob Catter. I watched Bob's video recently.
Yeah,
he struck me as being very Trump-like.
Right. I think there are a few differences there, but.
Well, he's not a multi-billionaire, so.
Tell us, and I don't think he has sort of fantasies about being prime minister either. But tell us what happened to the alt-right when Trump nominated. And it was from that opening announcement, wasn't it, of the... of his intention to run for president. Tell us what happened.
Well, before he made the announcement dating back to 2011, of course, he had been promoting the birther conspiracy theory for a long time and attacking President Obama for supposedly being illegitimate as a president. And he never let go of it. I mean, he was forced into making a sort of official repudiation of it midway through the campaign. But most Americans, including the far right, saw him as kind of a joke up to that point. But when he made the announcement in July of 2015, he made this speech that was openly anti-immigrant and denounced Mexicans as being rapists and so on and so forth. And that was when the radical right really sat up and took notice. They started taking him seriously. And they were like, oh, this guy might be what we need. This might be what we want. But then within a matter, and it was just 2 months later, I think in August, that he released his immigration plan. And that was the moment that really solidified for the radical right that he was their guy, because it was an immigration plan taken straight from the white nationalist agenda, and it was perfectly in line with what they wanted. So that was when David Duke came out and supported him. By the way, has anyone seen Black Klansman yet? Yes, great movie. So David Duke played a kind of a key role there in convincing the rest of the radical right. But it was also a lot of these young alt-righters, including Richard Spencer, who coined the term alt-right, and Andrew Anglin, who runs the openly neo-Nazi forum, The Daily Stormer. These guys came fully on board with Trump as soon as that he released that immigration plan. And from then on, we started seeing all this organizing on the radical right revolving around Trump. And it's very interesting because we've always had these elements in the United States, and they've tended to stay on the fringe. A lot of that has to do with the sort of nature of personalities that they attract, which are the people who are engaged in the alt-right are typically actually very contentious, nasty, paranoid, highly egocentric personalities, and they can hardly ever get along for any sustained period of time. They're really awful people to be around, and they can't stand to be around each other for too long either, right? And so the history of the radical right,
authoritarianism, isn't it?
Too many
alphas.
Yeah. And so the history of radical right in the States has always been that they've just never gained power because they can't stay together as a cohesive thing for very long. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that they've never had a charismatic figure around whom they can all unite. And Donald Trump changed all that. He was the charismatic guy that they could all, whose banner they could all organize under, and it was the missing element for the radical right in many ways. And so,
but you make it really clear he's not one of them.
Yeah. Well, they see him as a vehicle. Mm. It's about chaos for them. They see him as a vehicle for tearing down the old system. And he's perfect for that because he is tearing down much of what is the same. You know, a friend of mine on social media commented recently that in a conversation with an Australian the view in Australia is that people here will probably never be able to trust America again. He's destroyed our standing in the world so profoundly and so deeply that it's going to take years and years and years before we're seen as a reliable partner again. And I understand that. And that was exactly what they wanted. They wanted to destroy the old order. They wanted to destroy multiculturalism. They wanted to destroy liberal democracy because they are fundamentally authoritarian. They want to replace democracy and democratic institutions with an authoritarian state.
How How, I mean, it's a, you obviously don't know the answer, but you know that the temper and the culture at the moment about how this could shape up for the 2020 presidential campaign. What sort of a, what do you think Trump would take from all of this into a second campaign?
Well, he certainly learned that. I mean, demonizing liberals and demonizing democracy are keys to his being able to win. And I think he also understands that people respond to this, that his voters, who are people with authoritarian personalities, respond to his sort of authoritarian appeals, that, you know, what you need to do is listen to me, that I'm the source of all truth, and ignore the fake news, ignore the fake media, because they're not telling you the truth, I am, right? And part of the authoritarian personality is that they go, okay, you know. Mm. So I expect him to do more of that. You know, there was a very interesting, I caught this in a New York Times story of a year ago when the football players were kneeling during the national anthem, and Trump tweeted out and was saying these things in speeches that were really attacking these black football players. And New York Times did a piece on it. And about three quarters of the way down the story, New York Times does this all the time, was they buried, the lead was actually about three quarters of the way down the story, which was that they had this paragraph where they said, you know, everybody in the Oval Office and on the staff said, really kept repeating to the reporters that President Trump sees himself as engaging in a culture war on behalf of whites, his white working class voter base, and that this culture war was imposed on him and on conservatives by liberal Democrats, by Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton, and that he sees himself as essentially a culture warrior on behalf of whites. And, you know, it was really a perfect formulation of, you know, what his actual worldview is. And it really has been kind of missed in the discussion. A lot of people say, well, what is his ideology? And I would say that is his ideology, that he sees himself as a culture warrior.
Mm. If, you know, we could roll back time and look at the response of the left to Trump's nomination and the ridicule with which it was met, and you talked about how the right, that the alt-right, didn't take them long to work out this is a serious bid, but the left never worked it out. I interviewed somebody who worked in the White House for six of Obama's 8 years earlier this year, and he was talking about, I mean, up until the very day of the election, nobody in there believed it was even possible that Trump could have won. He was just mocked, and at that smugness that you hear about, that the left or the liberals are just so smug. Now, how much has that mattered in America?
Well, it does matter to some extent. I think that I will say, you know, I come from a fairly conservative upbringing. I grew up in southern Idaho, you know, family of Republicans. So I have a somewhat different view.
How was your Thanksgiving?
Oh, mine was fun because actually my dad was an air traffic controller. So we were, by the time, by mid-80s, we had become all Democrats. But But, you know, I was always a mixed ticket voter up until the Bush v. Gore decision. But, and then I realized the Republican Party was really toxic and was a problem. But I would say, so what I have observed about the left is that that we've lost our ability to persuade, that we don't see, we get into conversations and arguments with people on the right, and we are, can be very dismissive. We mostly look to win. It's like we're having a fight. And a lot of this may be, in fact, sort of a result of the nature of debate on TV, because this is where we see political discourse taking place. And these guys aren't arguing. When you watch a roundtable discussion on TV, nobody's trying to actually persuade the other person. They're trying to win the argument, right? And the way it's become kind of a lazy way to win is to simply wait for somebody to say something racist and then say, aha, you're a racist, I win. Bing! And unfortunately, you know, shaming doesn't actually work to persuade anybody. All it does is change their behavior. So they'll typically just stop behaving that way around you, but they won't, it wasn't change their attitudes, their underlying attitudes at all. And it is actually kind of a form of intellectual laziness, because in order to actually persuade people, you have to become knowledgeable in the subject. You have to actually understand why racism is fundamentally bad, why immigration really isn't the kind of issue that it's portrayed as by the right. I'm really kind of astonished by the number of liberals I know who don't actually understand the fundamental facts about immigration and aren't really able to argue it in a discussion with somebody from the right. They just wait for them to say something racist and think they've won the argument. So I do think that is a problem. And I think it has a lot to do with the way the discourse has gone. That said, what's actually a lot of the really underlying dynamic in the United States, and don't know that our change in approach would have actually altered that dynamic, because a lot of what's actually been going on in sort of a meta sense is that we have a cable network, Fox News, that 22 hours a day, 7 days a week, coaches half of America to hate the other half, on how to hate the other half. And why they should hate the other half, and you don't see, that doesn't happen on the other side. The mainstream media isn't doing that to conservatives, but the conservative media is very much doing that to liberals, and it's why now you'll actually hear them discuss civil war on Fox News. You know, it's really a problem, and so. I think the fact that, you know, and that this is a corporation that has a lot of money behind it, and they run Sky News here in Australia too. So
we're going to take questions from the audience shortly. So I'll ask one more question while you think what you might like to ask David. What do you sort of fear the most on the evidence that you see of these changes in American life?
Well, I mostly fear, most of all, I fear, you know, an increase in authoritarian personalities, authoritarian responses, fear of rise in authoritarianism. I think that, you know, at any given time, 20 to 30% of the American population has always had authoritarian personalities. And
what does that look like for those of us that might not recognize ourselves in that statistic, David?
Sure. Well, it's kind of, do you want, I'll try to give you the, sort of the quick discussion of it. But authoritarian personalities are built around three behavioral and attitudinal clusters. The first one is authoritarian submission, which is the belief that in order to have a safe and civil society, secure society, we all must submit to, we should submit to the rule of the authoritarian leader, a singular authoritarian leader. And then in the ultimate sort of version of this is the, you know, Hercules cutting the Gordian knot, somebody who can just cut through all the issues with their sword. Second is authoritarian aggression, which is aggression against anyone who fails to submit. And then the third is conventionalism, which is the idea that they represent the real mainstream, the real America in the American's case. And those three clusters create this whole series of, whole long list of really toxic traits, including compartmentalized thinking, which is this, you know, the ability, you put everything into this one compartment and throw everything else that doesn't fit into the narrative of that compartment out of it, which actually leaves you vulnerable to, it makes it possible for you to believe two completely contradictory things at the same time. It also induces, inclines you to conspiracism and conspiratorial thinking. And it also makes you, makes it so it's very easy for you to overlook bigoted and prejudicial behavior and maybe actually engage in it yourself. Mm. So those, that's what I really fear. And this is what we've definitely seen a significant increase in the United States in these kinds of personalities during Trump. This is why when Trump tweets out something about fake news or says something actually outrageous, that's just an outrageous lie, that his followers will still think he's telling the truth. Mm. You know, because that's how authoritarian thinkers think. And it's perfect for the radical right because they are fundamentally authoritarian, and they want to. That's what, you know. They're in the end, what I really fear is this undermining and attack on democratic institutions and on democracy itself. The desire to replace it with an authoritarian state. I don't think that's an issue that's confined at all to the United States. I see it in Europe. You can see it in the Philippines. You can see it in Myanmar. You can see it in China, all over the world, and obviously Russia, mm-hmm. Which has been one of the main sponsors of this spread of authoritarianism. I don't have a strong sense for how powerful it is here in Australia, but it probably is a problem here. So, yeah, when people say, well, I'm always asked, what can we do? What can we do? And I just say the number one thing, the simplest, purest thing you can do is get everybody you know out to vote.
I mean, we don't have to worry about that.
You don't have to have that problem here. But in the United States, it really is a problem because too many Americans spend too much of their time watching TV and see politics as just another form of entertainment.
When Obama came here at the airport when he was leaving, he said, he was asked, if there was one thing from Australia, what would you take home? And everyone expected, you know, I don't know, Queensland weather or something. And he said compulsory voting.
Yeah, I would too. Mm. So it's definitely one of the things that I tell people is that, you know, get everybody you know out to vote. Because it is an attack on democracy. It's an attack on the right to vote. I mean, you can see this in the initiatives that the Trump administration's been taking to take people off the voter rolls. And, you know, it actually is an attack on your voting rights. And so, obviously, you know, you don't have to deal with that here. I do think that everybody's democratic institutions are under attack. Mm. And it's important to stand up and defend them.
We have got some microphones, so there's a gentleman here.
Thank you very much. It's been absolutely fascinating. I'm intrigued by the fact that Donald Trump has won support not only from the alt-right but also from the evangelicals. And given that the alt-right seems to be hate-based politics, I'm wondering whether there is a crossover there between those two groups.
Oh, yeah. Well, and it's authoritarianism. Fundamentally, the evangelical right in America is religious authoritarianism. It's not surprising at all that they would engage in political authoritarianism, too. And I think it very much is the same personality types who are drawn to that sort of authoritarian style of religion that it very easily translates into political authoritarianism, especially when you look at where a lot of this, actual organizing for this has come from people who promoted the evangelical right as sort of a political initiative going back to the 80s and 90s. There's a terrific book on this by Nancy McLean, Democracy in Chains, that actually traces those connections between the libertarian far right and the evangelical right. And so that's very much part of it. A lot of the alt-right is not religious at all. but they all are very authoritarian. So.
Yeah. Thank you very much. It's been a really illuminating hour. Couple of quick questions together. So I appreciate what you said about getting people to turn out to vote. So in a country like Australia where that's compulsory, how else does a liberal democracy respond to this sort of a threat or trend? And also, how do we drive a counter-narrative to this? And where does the right to free speech go, given the responsibility, especially in the age of internet and conspiracy theories, mm-hmm. with telling the truth or some fairness?
Yeah. Well, in fact, that is kind of the one thing that I would say that you have going on in Australia that is also going on in the States is you have kind of a media problem that's similar to what I was describing with Fox News. You have a media... I mean, I was looking at the Herald Sun yesterday reporting on the change in leadership in the country, and I was struck by all these pages and pages of reporting on what's going on with the Liberal Party, and there was not a single word about how this affected the Labor Party, right? There's actually a built-in bias within most of the mainstream media against liberal points of view. It's often, we call it hippie punching in the United States. It's this attitude that people on the left are fundamentally sort of fuzzy-brained, and that people on the right are, you know, rock-solid normal thinkers, right? And this is really embedded in attitudes. So I would say that, you know, one of the real problems that we've got, or that we all have, is the kind of bad reporting that goes on because it's actually has a lot to do with corporate ownership of these media. In the United States, it used to be that most of the newspapers were independently owned. And since the 1980s, they've all come under the ownership of essentially seven different corporations.
We're heading for one, David.
Yeah.
I mean, we've got whole cities here that are one-paper towns. I mean, Melbourne's only surviving with two because Fairfax is in sort of palliative care. It won't be long.
Yeah.
Mm. What about the free speech component of the question?
Well, I would say one of the reforms that we all need, certainly what I would like to see in the States, is that people are not permitted to lie or that there's some sort of, that there's actually some sort of penalty or some sort of way of discouraging people from publishing nakedly false information. Because that's what conspiracists do. I mean, it's all fundamentally false information that they're spreading. And it's very easy to establish that it's false information. So I think, you know, it used to be that we had, and I think of Alex Jones in this regard, it used to be that if someone published lies about another person, certainly for me, this was one of my, you know, I worked as a news editor at most of the newspapers and at MSNBC that I worked at prior to going freelance. I was, you know, in charge of fact-checking and in charge of enforcing basic journalistic standards. Those standards have essentially vanished from most American newsrooms. We certainly don't pay fact-checkers anymore. We barely have copy editors who even have the time to do fact-checking or any of that. So a lot of this has to do with, you know, the way we fund our newsrooms, but it also has to do with those essential standards that we have in newsrooms. But one of the reasons we did this was that we would get sued. We were liable to get sued by anybody who we published false information about. So it was always astonishing to me that Alex Jones could publish blatantly false information about people for years and years and years and could get away with it. And he was able to get away with it because he actually had mastered this art of sending sending his flying monkeys out to harass people who questioned his stories. And people would get browbeaten and intimidated into not suing. Or they would be told that, you know, basically there were very few lawsuits against Alex Jones up until last year when the owners of Chobani finally took him on over these lies that he made about the Chobani yogurt operations in southern Idaho, which was run by, it was this Muslim man who had set this the nation's largest yogurt creamery up in farming country in southern Idaho, and they employed a lot of refugees. And so Alex Jones had done all these awful stories about how they were polluting this small white southern Idaho town. And they took him to court, but they didn't actually get any monetary thing out of it. They won the case, but the owner of Chobani is a nice man, and so he said, "Oh, I just want the apology," and he didn't hit him up financially. The parents of the Sandy Hook family have changed all that. Now, those of you who aren't familiar with what I'm talking about, you may recall the Sandy Hook massacre in 2010 of 28 school children in Connecticut. One of Alex Jones' favorite conspiracy theories for a while was this idea that it was a false flag operation. And one of the things that came out of it was this belief that these children hadn't actually ever existed. And so his flying monkeys started harassing the parents of these 28 children and telling them that their kids never existed. Can you imagine the humanity or lack of humanity of somebody who would do that? It's still mind-boggling to me. But this is what started happening to all these people. And so they have taken Alex Jones to court. The case is on trial right now. And I believe they're going to take him for a lot of money. And that's what needs to happen. But I think we need to find ways to sort of be able to reinvigorate that system, that it was a check on false information. And I think we need to reinvigorate that. Mm. So there are various ways we can still force people to, you know, that we can do, force people to maintain factuality and fairness without actually imposing restrictions on free speech.
In relation to the far right and the alt-right and the impact on economic authoritarianism, which you kind of touched on in that previous answer, but I just think that it just paints for us the difficulty of how to address that, maybe.
Thank you.
I guess I'm having trouble understanding what the question is. Could you, yeah?
The relationship
in terms
to economics?
Of economic authoritarianism, like so, them having economic power and cap, you know, capitalism and that kind
yes.
of thing. Yeah.
Well, it is one of the problems that I think that you know, business in not just America but around the world is still, even though we celebrate, we have democratic institutions, most businesses are set up as functionally feudalistic. structure, right? It's still very top-down, very authoritarian. And I think that's actually where a lot of this originates from. You know, a lot of the people who have pushed this sort of authoritarianism were people who didn't want to have to pay taxes and have done everything they can to game the system. But they've actually, the reason that they started affecting the media, I think, was that they realized that, you know, that democracy is their enemy and that their best bet is to actually get people, particularly those who are from the working class, to be on their side. And a lot of this has to do with the sort of appeals. And, you know, one of the things that we do say or that was sort of a thing in the States, I don't know how true it is here, but John Steinbeck once said that Americans don't see themselves as poor, they see themselves as temporarily embarrassed millionaires. Right? So we all want to think that one of these days we're going to be that rich guy, and we don't want somebody taking the taxes, right? And this is what they appeal to.
David Nywert and Sally Warhaft there at the 2018 Melbourne Writers Festival for the Fifth Estate. Next up, Sally will talk to Guardian Australia political editor Catherine Murphy about disruption in media and politics today. And that episode's in your feed right now. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you there.